I'd like to welcome you out. My name's Robert Burns. I'm the chair of the Northern Regional Advisory Council. We'll start with our introductions. Jim, if you'd...
I'm Jim Gaskill from South Weber, Utah, and I'm an at-large representative.
Paul Cowley, representing the Forest Service.
John Leonard, representing Sportsman.
John Wall from Riverdale, representing at-large.
Bryce Thurgood Perry, at-large.
R. Jeffrey Hicks, at-large.
Kristen Pretty from Ogden, non-consumptive.
Craig Van Tassel, sportsman.
Justin Doling with the Division of Wildlife Resources. I serve as the executive secretary, and I'm a non-voting member.
And again, I'm Robert Burns. From Centerville, and I represent the public at large. Our purpose tonight is to gather public input concerning wildlife management policy, rules, and regulations. The council will make recommendations to the Wildlife Board, and the Wildlife Board sets the policy for all protected wildlife in Utah. If you join me in turning the ringers off on your cell phones, we could have a nice uninterrupted meeting. When speaking, please come up to the microphone, speak clearly into the microphone so that we can get all your information down, who you are and your comments or your questions. Our meeting is recorded. It's then transcribed into some written minutes that are used by the Wildlife Board to look at our actions, and it's also part of the permanent public record. Also, if the council members would please speak clearly into the microphone, that'll help us with the transcription. Our standard operating procedure is we'll have a presentation. After that, we'll have questions from the public on the presentation. Then we'll go to questions from the RAC on the presentation. Then we will go to comments from the public. If you want to make a comment, please have a blue card filled out. They're on the table back there. Then we can call you up in order. We'll have people representing groups first, and then we'll have the general public after that. If your comments are in support of the group's position, if you just state that, we can go through. We don't have a lot of public here tonight, so we're not going to be too pressed for time, but that will be the comments from the public. After the comments from the public are completed, we'll go to comments from the RAC. Then the RAC will make motions. We'll deliberate on the motions, and then we'll have a vote. With that, we'll go to the agenda. The chair would entertain a motion to approve the agenda for tonight's meeting.
I move that we approve the agenda for tonight's meeting.
We have a motion from Jim Gaskill and a second from Paul Cowley to approve the agenda for tonight's meeting. All in favor, please raise your hand and say aye.
Aye.
It's unanimous. Second agenda item is the minutes for the May 15th Northern RAC meeting. You should have all gotten those by email. I didn't receive any comments about any changes. Are there any amendments to those minutes? Seeing none, I'd entertain a motion to approve.
I move that we approve the minutes as presented from last week, last meeting.
Is there a second? Second by Bryce Thurgood. So we have a motion from Jim Gaskill and a second by Bryce Thurgood to approve the Northern Regional Advisory Council minutes of May 15th, 2014. All in favor, please raise your hand and say aye.
Aye.
It's unanimous. I emailed you an update on the Wildlife Board meeting and a subsequent meeting that they had last week, I believe. Are there any questions on the actions of the Wildlife Board? Seeing none, we'll go to the regional update.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to share with you a few things that are happening in the region since our last get-together. We have two vacancies that we were able to fill since we last met. We have a new conservation officer by the name of Trevor Dahman, who is in our East Box Elder unit. And then Lou Ann Green is our new accounting technician in our Ogden office. So we welcome them aboard. And at this point, we're almost fully staffed. We do still have one CO, conservation officer, vacancy in Summit County. So moving on to the sections, our wildlife section is in the process of processing CWMU applications and renewal applications. Our region has a lot of CWMUs, and so it's a busy time of year for them processing those applications. They're also doing preseason elk and pronghorn classifications and surveys. And our cache biologist is in the process of updating the Willard Mountain Goat Plan, which is a unit plan that's due for an update about every 5 years. As far as an archery hunt forecast, in general, the west half of our region, which would be from I-15 out to Nevada, is fairly dry, and so if you've got an archery permit for the archery hunt, you'll probably want to keep in mind that the animals will be fairly clustered around water, and they may be hard to find, but once you find them, you should have pretty good numbers. The east half of the region is just about the opposite. The water conditions there have been really good, and so I think in the eastern half of the region, you're going to see scattered, really highly scattered deer, and primarily at higher elevations. So kind of keep those things in mind. There'll be more of a specific update on the archery hunt and a forecast that'll come out through our Salt Lake office. So keep those things in mind. Our habitat section is real busy controlling noxious weeds on our wildlife management areas. They're also working on our wildlife management area plans. And are preparing for a lop and scatter project over in the UN at Telephone Hollow. So a habitat improvement project over there for primarily big game. Our outreach section is in the process of trying to formalize this new wildlife recreation program that the division is undergoing. That new program will be housed in our outreach section, and it'll have four key elements. It'll have a hunting, an angling, a shooting, and a watchable wildlife element. And so our outreach section is busy trying to get that organized and provide opportunities for our wildlife recreation users. And just as a point of reference, the walk-in access program, which used to be under our wildlife section, has now moved over into our outreach section, and we will still have an active walk-in access program. It will just be housed under a different part of the division. In our administrative section, they wanted to remind everybody that SWAN applications start August 26th and they run through September 4th. We still have leftover muzzleloader tags in box elder and in Camas, Morgan Southridge, and Chalk Creek. Those units, excuse me, not Camas, East Canyon, Morgan Southridge, and Chalk Creek. And if those muzzleloader permits do not sell between now and the end of the muzzleloader season, they transition into rifle permits, and those rifle permits will be available beginning on October 6th. In our aquatic section, our biologists are finishing up the summer flatwater surveys, and they wanted to let everybody know that fishing right now is good for crappie at Newton and Pineview. So if you like to fish crappie, I encourage you to get out and either fish Newton or Pineview. And they also say that the fishing right now in the high Uintas is fairly good. It's a nice little reprieve from the hot weather down in the valley, so if you like to get up and fish some of those high mountain lakes, I'd encourage that. And then kokanee fishing at Porcupine Reservoir is starting to pick up. And so with that, I'll turn it back to the chair unless there's any questions.
Thank you, Justin. With that, we'll go to our first agenda item, the turkey depredation rule.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Jason Robinson. I'm the Upland Game Coordinator out of the Salt Lake office. I'm going to be talking about proposal for a new rule, 657-69, turkey depredation. Before we get into it, I'd like to give a little bit of background information on turkeys. Turkeys were extirpated from many areas in the U.S., and at the turn of the century, there was actually concern over the species going extinct. Turkey numbers were at their lowest in the 1930s. There's evidence that shows wild turkeys are native to Utah. There's numerous pictographs, petroglyphs, turkey bones, archaeological evidence. I included a couple of photographs there of some petroglyphs showing very clearly seem to be turkey tracks. Reintroductions in Utah started as early as the 1920s. Aggressive and more successful efforts began in 1989. And turkey populations are doing very well now, both within Utah and nationwide. And one of the things we want to make sure that people are aware and continue to be aware of is turkey efforts are a real wildlife success story, and we want to continue to promote that. Bringing those birds back and has been really great. One of the, I guess, consequences of all that success is there's been some areas of human-turkey conflicts. And so that's mostly what we're here to talk about tonight with this proposal. So you may remember the division presented the Wild Turkey Management Plan last RAC. That was approved by the Wildlife Board in June of this last year. Goal B under that management plan was to minimize human wild turkey conflicts and specifically to decrease the number of chronic material damage complaints by 25%. Going back a year and a half, Bill 342, Wild Turkey Management, was presented to the state legislature and was subsequently passed, which created Utah Code 23-17-5.1, which essentially requires the DWR to investigate and mitigate material damage to private property by wild turkeys. The division shall respond within 72 hours and have a variety of options available, including hazing, transplants, and additional hunts. What this law also does is give rulemaking authority to the Wildlife Board to administer provisions relating to damage caused by wild turkeys, which is essentially what this proposal is. So kind of to be clear, the law is in place. The division will respond to turkey damage. And what this rule does is kind of give the sideboards for how we implement that law that's in place. So again, proposed rule 657-69. So going into the actual rule, if a turkey causes material damage to private property, the property owner reports it to the Division of Wildlife. Material damage is defined as physical impacts to private property caused by turkeys that are visible, persistent, and detrimental to the landowner or lessee's use of the private property. The division will respond within 72 hours of receiving that complaint. The division may come in and remove the turkeys or implement a damage mitigation and prevention plan with the landowner approval, and ultimately both the division and the landowner would sign this prevention plan. So going into the damage mitigation and prevention plan, some of the options available would be for the division to provide educational materials that might help the landowner's tolerance of turkeys, haze the turkeys off of the property, exclude the turkeys using fences, tarps, or other means, capture and relocate the turkeys, which is probably going to be the main tool that we use in a lot of these cases. We still have a lot of places here in the state that we can move turkeys to. We can allow additional harvest, either through limited entry or general season permits, including fall hunting seasons. Sign the property up in walk-in access or the CWMU program. Offer a depredation hunt. Offer the landowner control permits. Or offer control permit vouchers. And I'll go into detail of these. So capture and relocate. Utah has a very successful history of capturing and locating turkeys. We have lots of places to move these turkeys. You may remember from last RAC, the board actually approved 231 sites statewide that these turkeys can go to. so we can capture them. We know if we catch birds and put them in the right habitat, they do very well. It is a very effective tool. Again, we're still trying to grow the turkey population here in the state of Utah, but it doesn't work in all situations, and so the division needs other tools available to help us help the landowners. The next option is a depredation hunt. So this is a focused response to verified reports of material damage. These hunts are in small areas with short notice and limited number of permits. If a hunter is interested in participating in this, in a depredation hunt, they would apply online on our division website. And then if a hunt was implemented, the hunter would be selected randomly from that pool of depredation folks. If successful, a hunter must have a valid hunting and or combination license and must also purchase a turkey permit. The DWR regional supervisor would approve the boundary, season dates, bag limits, sex of the turkeys to be harvested, allowable weapons, etc. Moving into control permits for turkeys, these may be part of the damage mitigation and prevention plan. It's a maximum of 2 control permits per calendar year. These permits would be for the landowner or leasee or immediate family member or employee. Each control permit is free, no cost to the landowner, and is valid for 1 either-sex turkey on the private property. The next option are control permit vouchers. Again, these may be part of the damage mitigation and prevention plan. DWR may issue vouchers for up to 10% of the documented turkeys on the private property, with a maximum of 15 vouchers per calendar year. These would be for the landowner or leasee or designated third-party recipient. So essentially, the landowner could select an individual and provide the permit to that individual. It wouldn't have to necessarily be related. A landowner may not gain financial compensation for the voucher's use. A voucher allows the holder to purchase a control permit. Again, they must have a valid hunting or combination license to redeem the voucher. And each control permit that they get after redeeming the voucher is valid for 1 either-sex turkey on the private property. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you. Now we'll go to questions from the public on the presentation. Is there anyone who has a question on the presentation? Seeing none, we'll go to the council. Jim?
Allowable weapons, does that mean that there may be weapons that would be prohibited during a regular hunt that would be allowed during a depredation hunt?
Probably not for the depredation, but there may be other weapons allowed for some the use of the control permits at the discretion of the landowner and the division.
Okay. What do the control permits cost anything?
If it's to the landowner, no, they can get those for free. The control permit voucher, if a person has a voucher and then redeems it for
that's what I'm interested in.
Then yes, there would be a fee associated, the regular turkey fee.
So they don't have to buy a turkey permit, but they have to pay the same amount of money as if they did.
They would redeem the voucher in for a turkey permit, okay. Which would be the same price as a regular permit.
All right. And I seem to recall in reading the proposal, but you didn't mention it, that there was a provision for the landowner to trap and transfer turkeys. Can you explain that and give me a little bit of the justification for allowing a landowner to catch and plant turkeys?
So that was in the original law that was passed through the state legislature, so it carried over into this rule. The division would still have to okay that and approve that. And I don't see us using it much, but if there was a landowner that either the division was stretched too thin or something and the landowner could do it and we felt comfortable with that, we could allow that to take place.
Yeah, I'm a little, well, it's not a question, never mind.
Additional questions from the council? Chris.
Jason, I'm also interested in the same point that Jim just brought up, allowing the landowners to do their own capture and relocation of the turkeys. So it brings up the, if they have the logistical ability to capture the turkeys humanely and appropriately, where are they going to relocate them to?
It would
if they are not part of the division?
The division would have to be a part of that process for them to be able to handle the turkeys. And so the release would have to be with division approval in one of the approved transplant sites.
So one of the 231 sites that we approved last board meeting, they would have to go there. So there'd be quite a bit of interaction between the landowner and between the division to allow the landowner to do this capture and release program on his own without it being led by the division.
Correct. The division would be very involved, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Jeffrey.
I just have a question maybe you can clarify about the vouchers. What is the reasoning behind giving them a free pass to give out to anybody they want? Is that just to satisfy the landowner, or is it you think they could get it to someone that could do a better job? I'm just kind of curious to why that was even in there.
Yeah, so not all landowners hunt, and we've seen that, and not all of them feel comfortable harvesting an animal. And so what this would allow them to do is to still deal with the problem, which would be the turkeys, but allow somebody that's maybe more skilled or more interested in hunting to be able to go onto their property and harvest a bird.
Paul.
Yeah, can you talk for a few minutes about the hunt area for the depredation and control permits, primarily the buffer discussion there?
Okay. So within the rule, we allow for up to 2-mile buffer. Essentially, what we're trying to do is help the landowner with the problem. It gives the division, in most cases, the hunt will take place on the property where the damage is occurring. We wanted to have the ability, if there was multiple landowners adjoining together that are having issues, that we could offer one hunt and a person could hunt on those additional properties. And so this buffer allows us to, in certain situations, give us flexibility to include multiple landowners. If that was the case, all landowners that were allowing for hunting to take place would have to be a signatory on the management mitigation plan.
And how do you see that as you bring in public lands within that 2-mile buffer? What would occur there?
It would be very, very rare, I think, to include public lands. The main purpose of these control permits is to help landowners with problem turkeys on their property. So I really don't see many, if any, situation. I mean, I won't say could never happen, but I think it would be extremely rare.
Okay. Thank you.
Bryce.
Do you think it'd be a stretch to, when the landowner comes and says, okay, I got the problems, and if they want to, you know, have the vouchers or they want to hunt them, to be able to work with some of those sportsmen's groups, say like Turkey Foundation or SFW or some of these groups, to get kids out to shoot them? Encourage that and say, you know, because sometimes, I mean, these guys are looking for ideas. They don't know what to do.
Yeah.
That way it kind of be a win-win for landowners and also maybe for some.
And the way the control permit voucher and control permits are set up, it's up to the landowner who those permits can go to. So I think if they wanted to work with MWTF and vice versa, I think it would be great.
Yeah, but I mean, so you guys have to encourage them because they're not going to think of it on their own.
And I think we could, yeah.
Any additional comments from the council? Seeing none, we'll go to the public for comment. I don't have any blue cards on this agenda item. Does anyone from the public wish to comment on this agenda topic? Seeing none, we'll go back to the council. Comments from the council? Motions? Paul?
So I would recommend that we approve the division's proposal R657-69 with the exception that on the hunt area for depredation and control permits that we add the wording after the 2 miles around the parcels of private property experiencing material damage excluding public lands. Then that would allow the individual who just collects a regular permit and goes out and hunt to really allow that to focus on hunting.
Is there a second?
I'll second that.
Discussion on the motion. Jason, do you have any heartburn with that? Would that be a problem?
I think we could make it work. I'm kind of racking my brain, just kind of going through examples that I've had. But I think in most cases that I think that could work for us. I mean, it could limit us in very rare circumstance where we might want to include that. But my experience so far is I think we could make that work.
Okay. Jim?
Well, it seems if all of the landowners involved have to sign on to it, that, for example, you'd have to go to the Forest Service as a landowner in the first place. With this, it simply says limited to public to private land, and I think that's a reasonable thing to do rather than burden the BLM or the Forest Service or whoever else with that kind of a thing. So I'm in favor of that.
Yeah. One of the reasons why I'm making that recommendation is if you end up having, say, a private landowner who has the vouchers and then gives it to a friend and then goes up on public lands, you basically have an outfitter guide situation, and they would be then under a special use permit requirement through the Forest Service. And so we're just trying to avoid that potential conflict that would occur.
Since there is no financial potential, could it actually qualify for that type of relationship? The landowner cannot have any financial gain by giving the voucher to another individual.
I think as long as it's friends doing it, I mean, and he doesn't get paid for it, there's no breaking the rules on going on forests as far as that I know, that I've seen.
Jim?
But if the landowner gives it to a guide, it doesn't say the guide can't make money on it.
I don't think there can be any transfer with the financial gain involved.
And as I read it, it only said landowner. Sorry, didn't get the microphone.
I don't think a third party can actually transfer the voucher again. It just says the landowner can transfer it to a third party. So the landowner couldn't give it to a guide, and then the guide.
No, he couldn't give it to a guide, but he could give it to someone who the guide recommended.
Who's being guided, potentially. Now, that's a different situation outside of the division's control. If a person has the voucher and then gets the permit and he hires someone to guide him, that's beyond the division's control. So... yeah. Any other discussion on the motion? John? Leonard?
I just see it as unnecessary, and the opportunity is rather... I see it as unnecessary in that to add that, and, you know, it just adds some complication that, you know, is probably not a problem and won't be a problem. And as turkeys tend to move back and forth, say from the forest. I'm thinking of the Mendon example. They might be up on the forest but move down and cause depredation. I can see the need for, you know, you want to, kind of keep after that particular flock if you're going to accomplish anything in discouraging the depredation. But I think those are rare exceptions. I'm more concerned with the fact that every landowner involved in that two-mile radius is certainly notified and is agreeable. Because the last depredation situation we had, all the landowners weren't notified within the greater area, and were pretty upset because you have landowners that like turkeys for the good they do for insect control and whatnot, versus one or two that dislike them. Yeah. And that was handled very poorly in last year.
In the buffer area, all the private landowners have to sign on.
Right now, in this proposal. But that wasn't true last year.
Yeah, in this proposal. So I guess if certain landowners weren't willing to sign on, they would have to be excluded from the buffer zone.
Right.
But I'm sure the division would, once the landowner tried to get those signatures, if they couldn't, they would have to go back and change their mitigation plan to exclude right. those areas.
And I would think the Forest Service or any public land agency that was being considered for the buffer, for being included within the buffer, would have an option to opt out.
Yeah. Paul, how long do you think it would take for the Forest Service to approve if they were required to sign on to a buffer area? It couldn't happen very quickly, could it?
It opens up the whole discussion on whether or not the Forest Service is making a decision, and then whether or not that decision falls underneath the NEPA process. And so it'll if that was ever brought into question, like it has been on other issues, that could definitely hold it up. Thus, another reason to make this a much more streamlined process and leave it to the private land.
Okay.
Because you could get someone who, once you submit a quote decision of that nature, they could then object to that decision, and whether or not that would fall under public notification, the decision was being made, et cetera, et cetera. It has the potential to bottleneck the process.
John Leonard?
I would think the division is well aware of that and would avoid that probably in almost all instances.
Any additional discussion?
Jason, would you just clarify why do we need a signature? And I'm just thinking about our big game buffers that we put around private land that go on to public land. We don't require a signature there. So is there something tied to the law?
Not that I'm aware of. Honestly, this is the first time this has been brought up, so I haven't had a lot of time to dig into the requirements. So we've tried to model this, the buffer zone stuff, more after our big game rule. So I don't think I have an answer at this point for if it would be required. It's not written in the law to have a signature.
Certainly, I would think we'd want to avoid that situation. I know as we deal with bears, some of that comes in for bait stations. We pretty much state, you know, we don't see a problem with allowing a station there versus we give you approval to put a station there. So there's some wording negotiation that occurs there also.
Any additional discussion? So if I could maybe shorten your motion a little bit and you tell me if it meets your requirements. Motion from Paul Calley, seconded by Jim Gaskell, to recommend approval of R657-69 as presented, with the addition of buffer zones would exclude public lands. Does that meet your?
Yeah, it does.
It's fairly short, so.
Oh, that gets to it.
Everybody good? Okay, I'll call for a vote. All in favor, please raise your hand. It's unanimous.
Thank you.
We'll go to item 6, proposed fee schedule for fiscal year 2015.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Wherever you disappeared to. Oh, there he is. Justin had disappeared. RAC members, members of the public, thanks. I'm Kenny Johnson, the Admin Services Chief from Salt Lake. And tonight we've just got a couple of fees to present. I'm going to try to go quick, and we'll stop at the most pertinent slides and dig into some details. So this is probably old hat for most of us here, but this is just how the fee process works. There's kind of a long, to implement a fee, it takes a while. And so the way the process works is we start here at our public process, the RAC meetings. We present our fee proposals here. Anything that goes through the RACs then goes to the Wildlife Board. Once it goes through the Wildlife Board, we take that proposal directly to the governor's office, and they review it and make recommendations to the legislature directly. And then we work with the Natural Resources Appropriations Subcommittee to kind of modify, reject, whatever they're going to do with the fee package, the fee presentation. And then any fees that committee approves gets included in the big bill up on the Hill every year, and all the legislators vote on it. And then anything that passes that process takes effect the beginning of the next fiscal year. So in this case, these fees would go into effect July 1st of 2015, so roughly a year from now. So it takes a while, and that's kind of why we're here presenting what we present tonight. So really quick, the division is funded primarily and always has been on the shoulders of sportsmen and women, so people who hunt and fish and trap and participate by buying licenses. The bulk of our revenue comes from their support directly. So this is just a quick look at how that breaks out. About half of that revenue directly from license sales, a third of it from our federal aid match dollars, again, which is primarily from hunters and anglers. A little bit of dedicated credits, so partnerships with other agencies and organizations that also contribute some funding. And then just a little tiny piece of general fund. So the little tiny red slice there is general tax money that we get from the legislature. And so what that means is occasionally being funded primarily with participation fees, we have to take a look at programs once in a while and see how close they're coming to paying their way. And so for tonight, we've got a couple of fees we're going to propose that we adjust a little bit. And we've got a couple of new opportunities that the fees don't exist for that we're going to try to put into effect if we need them in the future. So specifically, we've got some opportunities with Bobcat. We're going to propose a fee change for Bobcats tonight. We're going to propose a fee change for Muskrat, the way that works currently, and a future rule change for that one. And then we're looking at a two-cow elk permit, and then Rocky and Desert U Bighorn permits potentially in the future. And so just kind of by way of reminder, this is a fee discussion. Some of these ideas are budding or brand new, and so we know that there could be a use for tools like this in the future. This just gets the ball rolling and puts a fee in place that if we want to implement a couple of these in the future, we'll have the placeholder there. Some of the detail of how they work and how we roll them out will probably be yet to be determined, and any information about how it's implemented will come back through the RAC process again. So tonight's just kind of the fees, the fee side of that. So everything we've got on the list tonight, we think the revenue is going to be somewhere between $60,000 and $107,000, $110,000, somewhere in that neighborhood. We don't think it'll significantly increase revenue, but we think it'll we think it'll help where it needs to. And one of the things, that second bullet down, so you're going to hear a proposal a little bit later about some new recommendations for bobcat numbers, the number of tags available to trappers, and then the number that's available statewide. And so some of this depends on what we do with that implementation. And so what I've done tonight is I'll try to separate those two as we talk about the fee change and what the implications are. Essentially, what we're talking about, what we're concerned about with bobcat, is our cost to manage our fur bear program and our bobcat program continually increase. They have for the last several years, and we finally looked at it this year. So things like the rabbit transects, tooth aging, the John pelt sealing process, the admin side of things, the enforcement side of things, all those things add up, personnel time and everything else. And so we're here to kind of address that discrepancy tonight a little bit. Just a couple things in the market. Pelt prices last year were reported to us on an average of $407. These next few bullet points are probably the ones to remember as we go through the next couple of slides. On average, the program costs us, that's a conservative estimate, $191,000, just in managing our bobcat and fur bear program. And I did a little more digging as we kind of gone through the RAC process yesterday to find out what the enforcement side of that equation is, and that was an additional almost $40,000 in the field work that they do in tagging and in their time and wages. And so really we're looking on average the last few years of about $230,000 to manage the program. So from this one you can see a couple of things. So kind of remember that $230,000 number. I know there's a lot on this one. I'll try to move quick and still give you as much information as we can. The top of that is just kind of a projection based on what actually was sold last year in bobcat tags. So at $5, we sold about 4,400 of those to residents and 200 to non-residents, and that brought in $23,000 in revenue. And then I wanted to make sure fur bear license purchasers got credit too, because they do pay $29 for a fur bear license. We sold just under 2,400 of those for another almost $70,000 in revenue. And then non-residents brought in almost another $10,000 in revenue and fur bearer licenses. And so you can see the contribution to the program, just over $101,000. And again, the average at 191, which I hadn't updated this graph before, closer to the 230 a year, you can see that that's a shortfall annually of, you know, $80,000 to $120,000. So just a little bit of a shortfall there, and we're just trying to address it with what we're proposing tonight. So specifically, and this is based on last year's actual sales. So last year, bobcat tag was $5. What we're proposing for residents is $15. And then you can see the revenue estimate from that. Non-resident would go from $5 to $45 and a little bit of revenue there. So based on last year's actual sales, that new revenue would be about $52,000, which would help. It would go towards kind of closing that gap where the shortfall is right now. Now, the new this is the presentation you haven't seen yet, but you will. So what I did is kind of tried to predict what may happen in the market if we pass what Leslie will propose here in a little while. So those asterisks on the side there, resident bobcat with no quota and up to 6 tags per person. Our highest year when it was uncapped and the 6 was the max, we sold around 11,000 permits at $5. And so what I did is I just took a stab at what I thought that might do to the people that kind of buy those on the margins. And so we did about a 20% average that we think may not purchase licenses at $15, kind of based on what we had seen historically. So in 07, it was 11,000. We think with the price being a little bit higher, we might see maybe 9,000 people. So that's about 20% less, which would increase revenue a little bit more. So about 91,000 in revenue. And for non-residents, That's the same math as on that other slide. So, you know, additional brand new revenue would be about $100,000. So again, tightens it even more and gets us closer to where we want to be. So that is it for Bobcat. Muskrat, this one's an interesting program too, and it isn't recreational trapping. This program really is intended to meet some specific needs on our waterfowl management areas. So we try to get the right people removing the right muskrats from these areas. And the way it works right now, sometimes does that, sometimes doesn't. And so right now the fee structure that's in place, we don't think helps us to meet that objective. And so what we're going to do is propose that this fee, that second bullet down is the actual fee. In the fee schedule right now it says between $30 and $155. And that's depending on the number of muskrats that the trapper thinks they're going to harvest. So it's kind of up in the air. And so we generate about $560 in revenue, so it's really nothing that way. But we think dropping this fee from the fee schedule right now is probably the right thing to do. And then in the future, what we plan to do is just put this out so that it's more of a contracted process. So open it up for bid and let the market kind of decide who's going to do that. And then we think that'll attract the right skill set to actually have an impact on those waterfowl management areas. So we're proposing to drop it from the schedule, but then bring you guys a rule in the future and kind of explain how that new process would work as a contract. So you can see there's a couple things on this one. The current price, again, $30 to $155. We're proposing that just go to an open bid. And right now there's only 12 of those permits available, and it's just a random draw process right now that we run out of Salt Lake. And so you can see the associated revenue, just a small amount of revenue. But a little bit more, again, to help manage that process. The two-cow permit, this is a brand-new idea, so it doesn't exist in the fee schedule now. And we haven't really fleshed out how it might work on the ground. It certainly isn't going to replace what we're doing with cow elk tags right now, but maybe a tool in the future that we can use to harvest some animals where we need to with less people. And so that's kind of the idea behind it. Again, what we're doing tonight is just proposing a new fee. So there's not one now. A new fee of $80 for residents and $350 for non-residents. And we estimated a pretty low usage of that to start. So not a ton of revenue there either. So we've estimated 44 tags total. And that's to offset maybe some of what's happening out there in the antlerless world right now. And then really quick, the ewe hunting, so just a little bit of background here, and again, not being a biologist and not understanding everything about sheep. I love sheep, but don't make my living dealing with them. This one's an interesting new opportunity as well. So right now, that second bullet down, if we have sheep that are kind of problematic, if they're moving to areas we don't want them to move, there's potential for disease, those kinds of things. Right now, the process is our guys go get rid of them. And so one of the thoughts recently was let's let the public participate in that and maybe just have them help us with places that we know we're going to have problems. And so that's the idea, is maybe just put this in the toolbox for later as a population management tool, and then also share that opportunity with the public. And what we're proposing here specifically, $100 for residents for that opportunity. And again, very limited use. We're proposing, you know, maybe 10, and we just put that there as a placeholder. Non-residents would pay a little bit more. We're proposing $300 for that. And again, one permit. We don't know how it's going to be implemented. We don't know how the, you know, non-resident would factor in. But we wanted to get the fee in place so that at some point we can talk through it and make some sense out of it and put something on the ground that will help our biologists do their job and help the public maybe have a new unique hunting opportunity. So those are the main fees. And, you know, summary, really we're just making some adjustments tonight to do a couple things. Offer that opportunity, give our guys some new tools for for management, and then bring in the revenue to help continue to run those programs and offer the same opportunities that we have now. And that is all I have.
Thank you, Kenny. Do we have any questions from the public on Kenny's presentation? Please come up to the mic, sir. Give us your name and your question.
I'm Paul Roberts from Brigham City. And talking about the muskrat, you seem to restrict that to waterfowl management areas, but there are some other areas that muskrats do a depredation job. Any earthen fish farm ponds, Pioneer Pond, and also probably all the other urban fishery ponds, small irrigation reservoirs, some of the ponds out by Willard Bay, sewer treatment ponds. We need a way to...
Do you have a question for him, Paul?
Okay. How can they be included in the get rid of muskrat program economically as well as in times of low muskrat fur prices?
It's a fair question, and I don't know that I have the answer to it specifically. And our concern really is protecting those levees and things now. So the 12 areas we have identified are kind of why we're talking about it tonight. But I hope there's some market influences that push people to those areas, and just naturally the trappers are attracted to those kind of places and are getting access and removing those. I'm not an expert in that industry, but I hope that's there's kind of a natural market incentive for that to happen.
Come up to the mic.
This is just to deal with the muskrat trapping on state lands, on our managed things. Muskrats, if you advertised or got a hold of the Trappers Association, I'm sure that you could get participation on your areas or areas like that just by contacting them.
Thanks, Leslie.
Any additional questions? Please come up, sir.
My name is Brett Schmidt. I'm from North Davis County. My question on bobcats. Increase gave a lot of information. If you cover this, I apologize. Increase in the tag fee from 5 to 15, are we also increasing the number of tags an individual can have as well as the number of tags the state is giving out?
It's a good question. Yeah, there were two projections. So the first one was based on what we sold last year. And what you're going to hear is a presentation in a minute that talks about an unlimited quota and then six tags per individual. And so there's kind of those two, the two projections we did. One was a little bit higher than the other one.
Any additional questions from the public? Seeing none, go to the council. Jim?
Just wondered if you do the same kind of cost benefit analysis, so to speak, with say fishing and say CWMUs and depredation. That was very interesting. I hadn't ever seen that sort of thing presented to a RAC before.
Yeah, that's a great question. We do. We look at our fee schedule all the time and try to balance the two. And so you remember maybe last year the big fee proposal that we took out with fishing and combination hunting licenses. And so we do try to right size those programs when we think they're getting out of a line. And so, yeah, we do look at that quite often.
Kenny, did Justin Shannon talk to you about potentially having a limited entry deer tag similar to the elk premium limited entry tag? I think we talked about it in the elk management committee or the deer management committee months ago, but yeah. I can't remember exactly what our decision was. That was try to get that in the toolbox in the future if we changed how we wanted to do things.
He did talk about it. We talked about including it in this proposal, and at one point it was actually in here, and then we want to let the discussion happen further in that committee. So we thought it was a little too early to.
So you're going to wait another year before you try to get it into the queue.
Yep, I think that's where we ended up.
All right, thank you. Chris.
Kenny, by overhauling the system by which trappers will, you know, apply for, well, enter the bid process, shall we say, we're recognizing that they're really contractors. That's really, we're sort of overhauling their status. You know, you made a point to say they're not recreational hunters. They are helping us with a problem on our WMAs. But by requiring them to do in a bid process, they are contractors, is really what it amounts to be.
In this specific instance, yeah, the need on our waterfowl management area is absolutely. Everywhere else in the state, you know, it's all over the board. There's lots of different reasons people participate in that. But in this specific instance, we think that gives us the right people, you know, in the right places.
And we only have 12 because we only have 12 locations, 12 WMA locations. So when a trapper wins a bid, he wins a bid for a location. Is that right?
Correct. Yeah.
Okay.
Paul. Chris. Go ahead.
This question might be for Leslie, but I'm going to throw it at you anyway. Once a muskrat trapper wins one of those bids at one of those locations, is there an unlimited number of trap lines that he can run based on, you know, securing the one bid?
Yeah, at that point, the way I understand it, and I'll try to save Leslie a trip up to the mic, but I think they just work with our property manager, and they make sure that they work together to make sure that they're covering the right places, but I don't think there's a restriction on the number of traps or lines.
So the number is flexible, and now they're really being used as a wildlife management tool to get to the areas that have suffered heavily from muskrat depredation, where in other places where, you know, in a particular WMA where the depredation is not bad, they might not even run a line there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Paul?
Yeah, I was just a little curious on the cow elk permit. You only have 40 there, and yet I think we've got a lot more hunting occurring right now for cow elk. And so I'm wondering why that fee wouldn't apply to all cow elk permits.
So we didn't want to replace it with all cow elk permits. What we're doing now, we think, is getting us closer to where we need to be. So this one, really the number there is based on the revenue we were trying to project for the legislature. So we know that a two cow permit will cut into what we're offering a little bit. And so that was just a kind of a ballpark of where we thought we might end up with those.
Kenny,
if that makes sense.
Would that license be something that we would probably use to address populations on private property where we can't get people in there?
That's the idea. And there's probably a lot smarter people in here that can answer that one for me. But that's the idea. Where there's limited access in high elk densities.
And that'll be in a future rule.
Yep. Yep. Exactly.
Any additional questions from the council? Seeing none, we're going to go to the public for comments. Now, I didn't say it before, but if you're representing a group, we'll give you 5 minutes. If you're representing yourself, I'll give you 3. I do have a question when we get down to Cougar about who's actually representing a specific group, but I have one blue card on this topic. It's Kent Fowden.
Mr. Chairman, members of the RAC, I hope you can hear me. I'm Kent Fowden. I represent the Utah Trappers Association. We're strongly opposed to a 200% increase in the bobcat tags. We feel that if there needs to be an increase, it should be more incremental. The muskrat issue, is we commend the fishing game. That's something that the wildlife managers have needed as a tool to get the proper people in there to do the job that needs on those wildlife management areas. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That's the only other card I have that I think is for this agenda item. Is there anyone else who'd like to comment on this topic? Seeing none, we'll go to the council for comments. Okay, so based on the public comment, we do have One concern about the bobcat fee increase.
So was it the fee increase, or was it really for a discussion later on when we talk about the number of permits being issued for bobcats?
Well, this agenda item is basically, you know, for the potential 2015 fee prices.
Right.
So, and then he's concerned about the price increase, the potential okay. price increase. Yeah.
Thanks.
So. Seeing no discussion, the chair would entertain a motion. Bryce?
I make a motion we approve. Sorry, I don't have the agenda item in front of me.
Recommend the Wildlife Board approve the proposed fee schedule for fiscal year 2015.
As presented, thank you.
Is there a second? John Wall? Discussion on the motion. Seeing none, the chair call for a vote. All in favor, please raise your hand and say aye.
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 It's unanimous. Thank you, Kenny.
Thanks.
Next agenda item will be number 7, Cougar Management Plan Revisions and 2015 Recommendations.
Everything here is for tall people, so I'm challenged. So thank you for having me here. I have only been in this position for about 4 weeks, and I kind of came in the middle of some big changes, and so there's a little bit of contention going on, and I'll give you a little bit of background on what I tried to do. But yeah, hi, be nice. So the first part that I'm going to address, we were asked to do a Cougar Management Plan revision. And just a little bit of history on the Cougar Management Plan. The plan was originally approved in 2009. In 2011, some minor amendments were implemented. And in 2013, there was a lot of contention and things that had become apparent to the Wildlife Board. And so they directed the division to first simplify the plan and then return to a method where we would allocate permits on a unit-by-unit basis. There was one meeting prior to my starting the position, but when I started, it was about July 1st, and I couldn't take all of the changes that had been proposed in that plan. So I took the plan and I met with the Utah Houndsman Association, the United Wildlife Cooperative, and Sportsmen for Fish and Wildlife, and tried to work through some changes to the plan with the promise that I would take the next year to work with all of those groups and convene a Cougar Advisory Group again to work on a plan that everybody felt comfortable and happy with. Something that was easy, simplified, and incorporates all of our wishes and thoughts. So I made some very minor changes to the current plan that would get us through this year with the promise that we'll come back and do the plan as a group with input from all user groups. So currently, the way that permits were figured this year, we took, same as we did last year, we took 3 years of data and compiled it and analyzed it by area in order to determine permits. The previous plan locked us into 3 years. We would, if we followed the previous plan, we would be recommending exactly what we recommended last year with no changes. We are not doing that. We went ahead and analyzed the data, looked at it, and so you'll see some units have gone down in permits, some went up. And then the changes to the plan allow us to allocate permits and quotas on a unit-by-unit basis. So when you look at these recommendations, what you see is what you get. So that is the number of permits that we're recommending for the unit. It's no longer one big area and a quota over here equals the harvest over here and that type of thing. What you see is what you get for that unit. Now permits and quotas will be reviewed on an annual basis. So what we're going to do is look at the harvest every single year. If female harvest way exceeds the percent that we set up as a group, then we'll lower the permits for the next year. For that reason, we feel that it's the fail-safe, it's the safety valve that puts the stop on the harvest the next year. It has created some concern because some feel that it's not an immediate response. But it's similar to the way that we manage all of our species, that we look at the harvest and our recommendation is made the following year based on our harvest the previous year. So for that reason, I took female sub-quotas off. Because when you're dealing with really small units and numbers of permits, it gives you very little chance. So an example, if you have a unit with five permits, one of those can be a female. If somebody harvests a female the opening weekend, then the entire unit shuts down and nobody else gets to hunt there. So that's the concern with female sub-quotas. When we met with this group, they asked that we consider including all female cougars in our analysis. The current plan only looked at adult females. And so we did agree that as we rewrite the plan, that will be one of our considerations. But just as I was looking at the data, I also looked at it for this year to see if it would have changed anything that we were recommending this year, and it would not have. So our future plan is to work with all of these groups over the next year. We want to reopen the plan and take input from the Cougar Advisory Board to further simplify and make adjustments over the next year. And like I said, that group did ask us to consider a performance target in the future that includes all total female harvest less than 40%. So just a bit of definition here. When we talk about a cougar management area, cougars have very broad scale movements. They don't live in the hunting units that everybody's used to. So we tried to group hunting units together that represent what we believe would be the movement patterns for cougars in an area. So we call that a cougar management area. So each of those colored units are a cougar management area. So we pool the data for 3 years over that area. We look at the female harvest. We look at the lions that are treed per day. And that's how we figure out the permits. And then to manage hunters, we do that on a smaller scale, which is what you guys are used to, which is the cougar hunting unit. So each of the dark lines within the colored unit, that's a cougar hunting unit. And so those are what the permits are assigned to. And then we also have predator management units, which some of the cougar hunting units are defined, some of the cougar management areas and hunting units are defined as predator management units. And these are areas where we're trying to minimize cougar populations for the potential benefits to big game species. So these are areas where the deer population is below 90% objective or it falls below 80 or 85, I can't remember, Justin. 80% in 1 year, 85% consistently over 3 years. So our recommendations this year were based on the performance targets that were in the current plan. So our primary target, we look at the proportion of adult females in the harvest. We want it to be between 17 and 20%. So if harvest would have exceeded greater than 20%, then we would reduce permits for that area. Or if it was below 0.17, then we could increase permits. We also ran the numbers looking at 40% all female in the harvest, like I said, to determine if it made a difference in our recommendations. As a secondary target, we also look at, we do a pursuit survey of houndsmen, and we ask them to report the number of animals that they tree, and we realize that animals can be treed over and over by the same houndsmen, so so we realize that it can be a little bit biased. But we use this, and we want it ideally to be about 30%. And we can adjust the permit numbers up or down if it's lower or higher. So again, like I said, predator management units are units that are determined by the predator management policy. If a unit falls under this strategy, a region can choose a split or a harvest objective strategy for cougar management. Then permits and quotas are assigned to each of those units. In these units, the unit closes when all the permits or quota are filled or when the season ends. We currently have 3 units in the state that are unlimited take units for mountain lion. And the reason that they are unlimited take is the primary species that they prey on are bighorn sheep. There's little to no deer populations in these areas. And they are the Buttcliffs rattlesnake, the Kaparowitz, and the San Rafael. So to just take a look at historical cougar harvest, so this goes from 1990 through this past year. You can see that in the early 90s, our harvest on lions was quite high. Since that, we've reduced harvest substantially. We had about 330 lions taken this last year. So the yellow line represents the total sport harvest. The red line is our sport harvest for males. My words are getting confused. And then the brown line is the sport harvest for females. And is there a pointer? No. So you can see when the brown line and the red line are actually converging, you have half of your take is males and half of your take is females. That's what we don't want to see. We don't want to see that much of your take is females. We actually want the two lines to converge and be about where they are right now, which is the brown line is much lower than the red line. So like I said, we also looked at the percent total females in our sport harvest. And you can see that prior to 2006, probably about 2005, we were running right about 40% or higher. Since about 2008, we've been below that 40% line. I won't go through and name each of the dates. It's been standard from previous years on our dates that we're recommending for hunting this year, unless you want me to read them all. And then, again, this is just looking at percent females for all of those cougar management areas. You can see that on the Monroe unit, in 2011, it was right at 40% for all female take. The UNIS unit, it was about 42% in 2012. And then the Wasatch Manti, it was right at 40%. So if that current plan were into place and those were the numbers this year, those units would have a reduction in permits. We would be recommending that. One request out of the southern region is to take and split the Pine Valley unit into 2 units for the purposes of a bighorn sheep transplant. So they want to split the Pine Valley into 2 units, the Pine Valley North, which would be a split harvest season, and then the Pine Valley South, which would be managed as a harvest objective, and the sheep would be put into the pink area, which is the Pine Valley South. Just to kind of show you the trend in the past couple years of permits, limited entry and split permit totals, 2012 and 13, we were recommending a total of 347 permits. This year, it's almost seen 100 permit reduction, and we're recommending 253 permits for limited and split. Just to go through each of the units, limited entry permit recommendations did not really change at all from what was recommended last year, so I won't go through these. I'll only bring up anything that's changed from last year. So the Central Mountains Nebo. Let me find it here. So that had 15 permits last year. We're recommending a reduction of 7 permits. The Central Mountains Nebo West Face also had 15 permits last year. We're recommending a reduction of 7 permits.
That's a reduction to 7, correct?
Yeah. Well, to 8, because you've got the non-resident. So right. It's reduction from 15 okay. by 7.
All right.
Sorry. On the Mount Dutton unit, we actually increased that by 2 permits. We recently released some mountain goats on that unit, and so they want to kind of work hard on the lines in that area for a couple of years to help protect the mountain goat transplant. So we increased that unit by 2. The Pine Valley North is on here because it's going to a split, and then it's split from the Pine Valley unit. Plateau Boulder, we took one of the permits off of it and added it to Mount Dutton, so it has a reduction of 1. Plateau Thousand Lake, the same thing. We reduced that by 1 and added it to the Mount Dutton unit. Harvest objective unit quotas, there were a couple here that changed. The Fillmore Oak Creek was a split season last year. It is being changed to a harvest objective unit because we just recently released some bighorn sheep into that unit. The LaSalle Mountains, that unit is increasing by 5 permits, or 5 in the quota. Pine Valley South, that's the second one that's transitioning for bighorn sheep, and the quota there will be 10. The San Juan unit is increasing by 5. Let's see, the South Slope Yellowstone has an increase of 2 permits. The Wasatch Mountains of Inokwin has an increase of 2 permits. The Wasatch Mountains Cascade is a decrease by 7 permits. And the Wasatch Mountain Timpanogos also has a decrease by 7 permits. And again, this is based on this last year's harvest. And then, again, I mentioned that we have 3 unlimited take units. They're the darker brown colored units in southeastern Utah. They're the Bookcliffs rattlesnake, the Caparulets, and the San Rafael, and that's primarily because they only have bighorn sheep. And that's what I have for you.
Thank you. Do we have any questions from the public on the presentation? Please come up to the microphone and state your question. If you could give us your name.
My name's Aaron Johnson. I'm the vice president of the Utah Houndsman Association. Leslie, we've spoke a few times. I have a couple of questions for you, Leslie. When the Lion Committee met before you took over, they did some work. And isn't it true that they proposed a plan for this year?
This is true. The problem was that there was one meeting, it was held May 18th, and there were only 4 people that were present at that meeting. There was the livestock representative, Brett Selman, who's in the audience. There was the houndsman president, Dan Cockayne, I'm going to say his name wrong. And then Dave Stoner, Mike King from the Wildlife Board, and then, of course, John Shivick. So the meeting was held, but not all representatives that should have been there or provided input into the changes in the plan were present, nor did they provide input.
Who are those people? The way I understand it, the Lion Committee is a selected group. So I'm just wondering who was not present. I know that you mentioned earlier SFW wasn't present, but didn't they have the opportunity to call in?
No, the response back to them was that they could not attend the meeting at that time, and another meeting date was not offered.
Okay.
Sportsmen for Fish and Wildlife was not present. United Wildlife Cooperative, Kirk Robinson, was not present.
I don't want to speak for him, but didn't the United Wildlife Coalition call in?
I have no record of that.
They did.
And when we met, they didn't indicate that they had ever provided input.
So in the future, if a special interest group, for example, the Wool Growers Association or the Hounds Association misses a meeting, are you willing to throw away the plan and rewrite it for us?
No, in the future we'll have more than one meeting that everybody can provide input on, so everything won't rely solely on one meeting.
Okay. That seems fair. When we spoke in July, I was down there at that meeting with you in Springville with Byron Bateman and Chad Coburn. They both represent other interest groups. There was quite a few other regional biologists, and there is a question getting to it. Some of those regional biologists says that they didn't have the opportunity to attend that Lion Committee. But as I read the plan, isn't it true that the regional biologists are not members of the Lion Committee? They could come if they wanted, but they're not actually listed on the plan as Lion Committee members.
So I think what you're confusing is that the plan itself had not even had review within our internal agency. And once it was sent out within our agency, there were some serious concerns over the changes that had been made at that meeting.
From who?
From our internal people. They did not get to provide any input onto any of those changes.
Sorry, I don't mean to cut you out. Is that the public's fault?
No, it's completely our agency's fault.
Okay.
Yeah, and we freely admit that because of some personnel issues, the things that we should have done over the past year were not done, and that's why I'm here.
Okay. And I appreciate you owning that. We look forward to working with you in the future. We also spoke at the meeting, and you talked about, you know, managing lions. Does the division manage, I'm calling them lions, cougars, pumas, whatever you want to call them, BYU. Does the division manage mountain lions for mountain lions, or do they manage them for deer and elk?
We have to manage them for the benefit of all people in Utah, and that means all user groups. So it does mean houndsmen, it means sportsmen, it means mule deer people, it means urban and nuisance wildlife concerns, and so we have to take everything into consideration, not just houndsmen.
As you should. Is there a pecking order? Is one species worth more than another in the division's eyes?
You know, that's an internal philosophy thing, but no, in my opinion, it does not, because my job here is now to represent mammals for the state of Utah, and so that will be my primary concern. But we will work with everybody and all of the user groups to develop something that benefits everybody.
Okay. You mentioned briefly that the Wildlife Committee instructed the division to take a look at the plan and fix it this year. So this last year that we were supposed to fix it, and we failed, I guess, and so we have this temporary one now. Part of your temporary plan was to take out the female subquota, and you touched a little bit on that in your presentation. Is there a scientific, like management book or a scientific study that you're referring to that kind of gave you the idea to take out the female subquota, or is it merely just a number issue?
So what I'm looking at, when I recommend permits here, this is the harvest that we expect to take off of a unit based on the numbers and the population that we determine a unit can sustain. Okay, so we expect if we put out 14 permits, you can harvest 14 lions. Okay, that's what we expect. By putting a female subquota onto that, you're severely limiting or capping our ability to harvest this. Okay, and we're trying to maintain populations at a certain level. And so I'll give you an example here. The cash unit last year, which, let me find the map. I have to go all the way here. So the cash unit last year had a female subquota on it. The unit, which is all of the blue units there, closed down early. I think it was February 8th or something like that. We have some units there that are along the front that we end up with nuisance cougars in town and all of that. So we need to have the harvest there. But because the female subquota was met, and it was met early, we didn't get the harvest there that we needed. And so by having the female subquota on there, it limits our ability to manage populations. And I honestly, truly feel, I mean, all we're doing is we're stepping back to where we were before we had this plan in place for the last 3 years. We're essentially stepping back to what we had before, which was a number of permits, and that's what we expect to be harvested. And before, when we had that, we did not have female subquotas on those permits.
And we spoke about this at the table earlier. Once again, there is a question here. But on the lions are broke up in different management styles, limited entry, split, or harvest objective. On a limited entry hunt, if you give five lion tags per se, all five of those can be females. There's going to be five lions taken off of that unit, and five people have a chance to take it. Is that not correct?
Yeah.
So removing the female subquota from a limited entry hunt means nothing.
Well,
in essence, because they could, for that year, because they...
Let me explain something, though. When you do a limited entry hunt, you can't have a female subquota.
Right.
Because you have people that have waited 11 years to draw out for that unit. And so if you put a female subquota on it and somebody waited 11 years in the opening weekend, somebody went out and harvested the female the opening weekend, and those four other people never even get a chance to go out, you know how mad our public's going to be that we... do that to them.
Right,
and so we can't do female
subquotas. That's a misunderstanding maybe on your part of the plan. If you draw the limited entry tag for the, let's say, the Park Valley Raft River gives five limited entry tags and one non-resident, those six individuals that have the tags can potentially kill six female lions.
Yes.
No matter what this female subquota. So in essence, the female subquota only affects split units which turn to harvest.
Under the previous plan, limited entry harvest counted for that whole unit. We're doing away with that.
In
the previous plan, limited entry harvest counted towards the whole quota for that whole area. And that's what happened on the cache. You had people that went out and harvested during the limited entry, and they harvested females, and it shut down the entire unit. And we did not get the harvest that we needed in the areas that we needed it.
You didn't get the harvest on the harvest objective areas.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, it never transitioned. It closed after the limited entry hunt.
And those female subquotas, if I'm not mistaken, and I'm not a biologist, but trying to represent the club more, I've read several of the lion management books. The female subquota theory in science is based exactly on that, on
the
science.
Female subquota works when you're dealing with really large areas and bigger numbers of permits. When you're dealing with fewer than 10 permits in some of these areas, it's too conservative for what we need to manage for.
So if you're dealing with fewer than 10 permits, would it be best to manage those areas on a limited entry or a split unit?
Possibly, but that's what we can work out when we rework the plan over the next year.
How does the division count cougars or mountain lions? How do they come up with their numbers? Do they go out and count them like they do deer? Or?
Well, as you know, that's entirely impossible to do. So we base it on trends and harvest over several. And if you look, you can. I mean, we have to base it on trends.
So,
And what's reported to us through pursuit, surveys, and all of that. But, yeah, we completely rely on trends in our harvest.
So is it fair to say that lion mortality, what's checked in, is basically a huge, if not all, the way that you manage the lions? Like, you do take some of the treed stuff, but that can be skewed. So you see how many lions were killed and decide, there's that many lions in this area.
Well, but we also rely on what you guys as houndsmen tell us.
Okay. So unless we're a private property owner with a sheep herd and we tell you that there's not too many lions and you can't see them behind every bush, you would believe that.
Well, so you can look back here in the 90s, and we hammered mountain lions back in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
If you look now, we've kind of stabilized our harvest, and we're staying at a steady stream. So you're not seeing huge jumps in our harvest. If you started to see huge jumps in our harvest, it means you probably have a bump in your lion population because you have more people harvesting. But the other, you know, the other thing that you have to consider is you have to look at what's harvested in order to determine. I mean, you're dealing with something you can't fly. You can't go out and count transects or anything like that. So we have to base it on trends.
Right. And if I'm not mistaken, even in the future, you're going to look at the number of females that are killed as a primary factor in lowering or raising tags or whatever.
Absolutely. We're just not going to respond immediately like you're asking us to because of a female subquota. We're going to take and look at the overall harvest. And if it meets whatever level we end up determining as a group, it may be the same as what we already have. But when it goes above that, we'll decrease permits. When it goes below that, we'll increase them.
Okay. And one last question about the immediate stuff. There's a question to this. So, last year, being involved in this management plan, they made a lot of different proposals. And one of the things they did was they, on a specific unit, they said, well, we're going to make this unit a harvest objective. It was based on the large management area. So on a small unit that typically harvested 10 to 12 mountain lions a year, the division's plan last year, when they made it a harvest objective in the large management area, made it with the potential that 40 mountain lions could be harvested out of that area in 1 year. It's the book list. And the houndsman got up and said, if you do that, you're going to kill 40 mountain lions. And everyone says, we won't even come close to that. Do you know the number of mountain lions they killed in that area last year?
Yeah, 35.
Is that pretty close to 40, three times the normal
number? Yeah, I get that.
Okay. So there's a huge concern from the houndsman. There's a question with this. With some of these management ideas, that females, which is our source of mountain lions, just like they are with deer, does, cows with elk, could be potentially over-harvested in 1 year and affect the lion population for years to come.
Okay, but you're also forgetting that the Buck Cliffs unit is harvest objective because it's under predator management currently. The deer population there is less than 60% and has consistently stayed that way. So it entered under predator management with a fairly high potential to harvest mountain lions because we are trying to lower the population there to increase deer.
Right, right. And I don't want to argue that. It was just the fact that the houndsman came in and said, you could potentially kill this many mountain lions, and no one believed him. And they almost did.
If you're putting that many permits there, you have to expect that it's possible.
Sure.
And for us to say that it's not possible is not fair because we put it out there that you could.
So without a female sub quota, the question is this. Potentially, in some of these areas, for example, the Buck Cliffs or an area up here north where there's no female sub quota, you could potentially kill 20 female lions in that area.
On a harvest objective unit, which is under predator management, it will not make sense to have a female sub quota if you're trying to decrease the lion population in that area. You target the females in order to decrease the population. So a female sub quota on the Buck Cliffs unit would not work because we're trying to lower the population there.
And that's for deer?
That's for deer.
So at all costs?
Deer and bighorn sheep.
Okay.
I mean, that's part of the predator management policy, and that's what we have to manage.
We'll have to discuss this more because I think that the deer goals are outlandish, like they won't be reached. They probably didn't.
Question.
Grandpa's time. Yeah, here's my question. So let me get back on the train of thought. On the immediacy of for example, if we have a problem and we see that 10 females have been killed in an area, that's going to be way over the 40%. Is there a safe stop that we can do right now to stop the killing?
No, it would be addressed the next year with our permit recommendations.
So the division would not entertain any immediate closures on a unit if...
No, because it falls in line with the way that we always managed prior to this plan, which was we looked at the harvest every single year and we made recommendations the following year for each unit based on the harvest the previous year. We've not had the safety valve in there until this current plan when we started getting into large area management.
I don't want to put words in your mouth, but didn't we talk in July at this meeting that if we started, for example, on the book list
Wait a second. Let's focus on the questions on the presentation, okay? Because we're not really discussing the meeting in July. What okay. we want to do is focus on this presentation and what is on the table, okay?
Okay, so there's no safety valve to stop a unit this year. We couldn't go to the Wildlife Board and ask for an emergency closure like we have in the past under this.
Well, you could
plan.
Do that, but there's not a female subquota in place that would provide the division the means to close a unit because of female harvest.
Okay.
No.
That's it. Okay,
thank you very much. Additional questions from the public on the presentation? Come on up.
Justin Smith, Houndsman. I just came tonight just to voice my concerns on the female subquota. Heard we were getting rid of it. I hunt the Wasatch Front, East Canyon Davis. Yes, I do.
Okay, question four.
That female subquota, East Canyon Davis, five cats. You lump in that whole cache area. You can kill every cat on that whole place.
Is there a question?
Yeah, the question is, how do you feel that's right? You know, I mean, it's out of control just because you've got these big units.
Focus on a question.
Okay.
Because we're going to have a comment period, and that's when comments are relevant.
That's when I probably should have come up then.
Okay.
So I'm just voicing mine.
Okay.
So get up here again on that, but we need to go back to the smaller units and the female subquota. It's going to wipe them out.
And that's what we did. We went back to smaller units, but without a female subquota.
Okay, any additional questions from the public? Seeing none, we'll go to the council. Questions from the council on the presentation. Okay, we'll go to comment cards. Now I need a clarification first. I have two comment cards that... one says they're representing the Utah Houndsman Association, that's Aaron Johnson, and then I have a comment card from Mitz Herzog, and he also has he's representing UHA. So one person can represent the group and have 5 minutes. If you'll pick which one of you want to do it.
Mitch's shot. Hey, Aaron Johnson with the Utah Houndsman Association, I'm their vice president. Leslie, sorry, I hope I didn't offend you.
Not at all.
Really do look forward to working with you guys in the future. We appreciate what the RAC does. We also donate our time going to these meetings, taking days off work. It's important to us, and so we appreciate it. This letter was sent out to all the RAC members. I hope that you got it on your email and had a chance to read it. I'm not going to read through it, but I hope everyone did take the time to read it. Basically, the Houndsmen believe that we did everything that was asked of us. We attended the meetings when the division set them up. We went there and we expressed an opinion. And we did come to compromises and a plan that made, when we left the meeting, what we thought everyone happy. The divisions owned up, and then they threw that plan away and have this. We see that as a failure. They were given direction from the Wildlife Board to fix the plan. They haven't. They're asking for another year. And we do want to work with you this year to fix the plan. But that being said, some of the proposals that are being made we think could greatly affect the lion population, especially up here in northern Utah where we're not killing 20 lions a unit. We're killing 4 and 5 on limited entry hunts, primarily some split units and some harvest objective. We feel a female subquota protects our lion population. We realize, and I want everyone to realize that we're not against deer, we're not against elk. We just think that the lion's a trophy animal. It's an animal that belongs out there. We enjoy the sport. We enjoy hunting them. We would like them to be managed as a trophy animal and as a good species better. That's our concern. The points, I do want to commend you on moving the units or moving the plan back to the individual units. I think that that will help in the future. And we are a proponent of that, taking the big, larger areas, getting rid of them and managing it unit by unit. But we ask you to to vote to reject the DWR's proposal as it is presented. We are in favor of moving it to the units. Dave Stoner has been, correct me if I'm not wrong, a biologist that has assisted the division in the past on these lion things. He recommended that a female subquota should be set somewhere around 40%. We believe that's too high, but that's a compromise from us. And if the science suggests that, then that's what we suggest, that there's the female subquota put in this plan this year while we fix the plan so that we don't have a catastrophe for next year. And we appreciate the fact that you're willing to consider all females in the harvest. That hasn't been happening in the past. And then we also vote, and I think it would be a great tool for the law enforcement, that we require a GPS location on all cougars harvested. This makes sense. 90% of the houndsmen have GPS units. If you're going to harvest a lion, you can get a GPS unit unit and borrow it. Give the GPS coordinates of that kill to the division if there ever was a concern about where that lion was killed, if it was killed out of bounds, per se, in a different unit. This might help clarify and give law enforcement a good tool to correct that. So we think that that's just a no-brainer suggestion that should be in there. Do you guys have any questions from me for the Hound Association?
John?
Yes, sir.
I've hunted lions a few times, and isn't that houndsman got the most control over if they're not have the tag themselves or taking somebody out to talk that individual out of a female or, you know, convince him that that's not the reason he's hunting?
No, that's a great question, and the answer to that is yes, they do. There's different types of houndsmen. I hope this doesn't cut into my 5 minutes. It's his question.
You were about done, I think, when he asked you that.
There's the lay houndsman like me that does it as a hobby and trains dogs. And so, yes, I could talk you out of killing a beetleman. There's outfitters out there that do it for a living. And they may not be as motivated to talk him out of a female. And we understand that, too, because that's how they feed their family. So to say that, well, the houndsman can go out and control it and not kill any females, yes, we can. But what do you tell an outfitter when he's trying to feed his family? Don't kill it. And so females get killed. That's the reality. And we understand that. So it can happen. If you pay an outfitter several thousands of dollars to kill a mountain lion and you hunt for 7 or 8 days and you get to one tree and it's a female, that might be worth $7,000 to, you know, or whatever. So they come out of the trees just by the nature of that. Are there any other questions?
Looks like we're...
I just have one. Based on what I've heard you mention to Leslie tonight, part of what the division's done for this coming year you like, and part of it you don't, and yet you don't like the process. Is that... Did I correctly state that?
Somewhat. We thought that the process was completed. We went to the meetings, and we left the meeting with a lion plan, and then we were surprised to find out that the division, a couple weeks later, through all of the work, whether it was one meeting or not, there's a lot of work that's done behind the scenes and not just at a meeting.
Oh, I understand that.
Threw that away and came up with this, and they said, this is what we're doing instead of everything that you agreed on. So that part of the process we didn't like. We hope that doesn't occur next year. I don't believe it will.
I don't think it will either.
No. I really look forward to working with Leslie. I don't have anything against her. I think we'll come to a really good compromise next year. The goal, I told this to Leslie, sorry, I'm long-winded, we don't want to come here and argue. We want to come here and say we agree with what the DWR proposes. That's our goal.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Thank you, Aaron. Mitch Herzog.
See, that's somebody that can identify with my height talent here.
Right.
There you go.
I feel you.
I'm Mitch Herzog. I'm a board member of the Utah Houndsman Association as well, and I support the letter that we sent out and the five things that we're wanting to look at and vote on. And so... Thanks.
Thank you. Justin Smith.
Oh,
you're You want to be last?
No, I mean, that's all I had to say.
Okay, you're good. All right. You would like a female subquota?
Absolutely.
Okay. Brett Selman?
My name's Brett Selman, Tremont in Utah, sheep man, wool grower. Appreciate you guys listening to all this, and welcome. Is it Leslie?
Yeah.
On into the fire here. I have sat on the Lion Committee since 09. Was that when it was?
Mm-hmm.
I was to the meeting in May, as you mentioned. I was not to a meeting in July. I don't know how I missed that. Stoner was there, the houndsmen were represented, and we have a double check if we have female subquotas, like Leslie's been trying to explain. It's not immediate, but it's coming if there's too many females killed, which in my opinion is impossible. These lions that are causing sheepmen problem, they're on private ground, they're in our backyards. They are our biggest problems are the females. We need these cats taken out. We're on a split unit on these areas. In the cache, we were shut off. We had no recourse other than other recourses to go and take care of these problems. Again, we need these help. We need these females taken. They are our problem. There's sheepmen going out of business. It's an industry killer. We're losing sheepmen. They're going to be gone. These lions, in my opinion, are going up. We're having more and more problem on these ranches. We've lost 26 on one herd this year since June, and 14 on another that we've found. We're getting more and more trouble all the time. I think we need a big male subquota. The big males are the ones that keep our population in check, and we don't have that now. We have a bunch of juvenile delinquent lions running around without Papa to keep the numbers in place. And I look forward as well to working with you all and continue to solve this problem. Oh, and by the way, I think you said we cut lion tag numbers statewide by 100.
Part of that is because some of them transitioned into harvest objective, and so those don't count.
But we're still going to kill 100 less lions in the state this year than we did last year and the year before, right?
Yeah, but it gets taken up in the harvest objective numbers.
Okay.
Just limited entry and split reduced by 100.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Mike Schultz. Mike Schultz.
My name's Mike Schultz. I own property in Morgan Southridge Unit. I'm a hunter, probably a wannabe houndsman. I don't actually have dogs, but one of my best friends have dogs, and I gave up snowmobiling when I discovered mountain lion hunting or cougar hunting, whatever you want to call it. But it's something that I do enjoy, and I have a great time doing it. I enjoy hunting. As well, deer hunting is probably one of my biggest passions there is. I'm here just to talk strictly on the Morgan Southridge unit. The Morgan Southridge unit population of cougars, lions is increasing drastically. Very rarely do we go up on our property and not catch a lion in the wintertime. And a lot of times it happens every year where we, once or twice a year, we'll catch, two different lions in the same year. In the same day. And before I started going up on this property that I purchased 3-4 years ago, my whole life, and I'd spent a ton of time in the outdoors, my whole life I've seen one lion in... in the wild, actually physically without dogs, just driving down the road or whatever, being out walking through the field, seeing one lion. It is not uncommon for me to go out during the year, during the summer, and see 4, 5, 6 lions in 1 year. Physically put eyes on them without dogs, without whatever. Example, well, over the last 3-4 years, since we've owned the property, we've killed 5 lions off of just the area where I own, which is almost 1/3 of the Morgan Southridge lion, total lion tags. That being said, we're still seeing all these lions. Talking to my neighbors, same thing. They're seeing drastic numbers of increases in lions in the Morgan Southridge unit. Yesterday, or a couple days ago, I'd put my cameras out probably almost about a week ago, went and checked them 4 or 5 days later. I had a picture off a handful of different cameras, but off 2 different cameras, I had 6 different lions, 4 in one picture and 2 in another picture, so there's no way that they could have possibly been the same lion. So, and this is on a 11,000 acre place, and Morgan Southridge definitely it numbers are increasing drastically. So just keep that in mind as you're looking at your numbers. And Leslie, sounds like you're doing a great job. Appreciate you looking at everything, because I'm a guy that likes balance. Like I said, I have just as much fun hunting lions as I do with the deer. So, any
thanks.
Questions? Anyway, thank you guys.
Thanks.
I have a question of this speaker and also of Brett. It wasn't clear to me if you're in favor of the proposal or not.
Well, I would I would probably shy away from the female ejective unit. I like Leslie's idea of looking at it year to year instead of all of a sudden just shutting it down. I think if you're managing to kill lions or to have a certain amount of lions, if that starts dropping down to below, if the graph starts dropping down below where you want to have where your objective is, at that point in time you look at it and say, okay, it's time to reduce the tags, or maybe for that unit, let's put a lion quota in place for that particular unit. But to just say statewide, put a lion quota in, I'd probably disagree with that, because there's certain areas that have a high population of lions, and I think that would defeat the purpose of trying to keep it in check, I think, as Leslie tried to explain. So I think certain areas, I think it fits. Statewide, I probably would disagree with it.
Okay. I wasn't expecting a long answer.
Sorry.
Just kind of like...
I like to talk.
Yeah, I like it or I don't like it.
Thank you, guys.
Brett, you want to make a yes or no for us?
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll have one additional comment card that didn't want to speak to the council, and Tyler Farr supports the Utah Houndsman Association's presentation. Are there any other members of the public who'd like to comment on this agenda item? Seeing none, we'll close it off to public comment and go to the council. Comments from the council. Jeffrey.
I was not going to make too many comments tonight, so I'm trying to keep it down. My comment is that each year we come across this cougar issue, and each year the houndsmen bring up some issues, and usually they're pretty darn valid. Pretty rational every year, and I think they are again this year too. I always end up on the bad side of the stick, it seems like. So I tend to want to give you guys their opinion some weight, but I tend to lean towards wanting to give you a chance to revamp this thing and do it right and with everybody's concern. But the one person brought up a question about, I know this is kind of a question, but about the GPS. Would that help you in managing that, or is it truly just a law enforcement issue if they had a GPS every kill?
Honestly, for the past 12 years, I've been So prior to this, I worked in the disease program. And part of our request was to request location of kill on deer and elk so that we can do our disease testing. It's very difficult to even get that. We can require it, but it kind of becomes an unenforceable thing. Honestly, I believe that it makes the honest people honest and more honest and the dishonest people more dishonest, because it's not that difficult to create a point anywhere. And honestly, if it's a law enforcement issue, they'll be able to ferret that out as they work on the case, I believe. But I mean, you can require it. We'll try and it's just hard to enforce.
Okay, so it's kind of like having a bike lock. It only keeps the people that don't really want to get the bike honest. All right, I was just curious about that. I do tend to think that we ought to give you another year to get it revamped. But the houndsmen always seem to have some good points each year, and they usually get the short end of the stick, it seems like.
Bryce.
A couple questions. Like, so you ask them to tell you where they're at, and if they're not honest with you, I'm wondering how honest they are when they say how many lions they've treed. Because that, I mean, if I was a houndsman and you asked me if I didn't think there was enough lions, every day I'd say zero. So I don't understand, how that is really a good fail-safe.
I think that we survey enough people that it accounts for that, because you do have honest people out there. So if somebody's being dishonest, I mean, it's just one of those things. It's completely biased and it's a hard metric, but as we've worked with Dave Stoner, it's one of the most valid metrics you can use. So we try to rely on it, but we don't base everything on it. It's a secondary target. Okay.
Jim.
So I think for a long time the division has assumed that there was the same percentage of liars, and so you look at trends more than you look at numbers, correct?
We try and look at trends. We try to base everything on trends so that we stay steady. We don't want to see huge jumps or falls. We try and stay steady.
Paul?
I guess I find myself concerned if we're saying that the process did not work well this past year to put in a 3-year plan, and yet we turned around and changed the plan anyway. And that's not to discount Brett's concern and the issue on his land up there where he's losing a lot of livestock. And yet it seems to me as if it's worked for the past 3 years, and there may be some errors in it, to let it work a fourth year as you revise it for the coming 3 years, maybe a better choice than doing a change without the public process through that Cougar committee.
To be honest, it never went a full 3 years. And if the Wildlife Board would have not directed us to change it, this would have been part of those 3 years.
Okay.
But they directed us to change it because of the unhappiness from the public.
Jim? You're thinking?
Getting ready to pull the trigger.
Leslie, I don't envy your position, but I think everyone up here on the council has been through quite a few reviews, and we do have a lot of houndsmen in our region, and so we've heard a lot of these concerns before. We also all understand that it's impossible to count cougars, and it's really a trend. And so we get both sides here. We get people who say we can't find any cougars, and we get people who say there's too many cougars. But hopefully moving forward, the process will include everyone. And I've been on several committees. I don't want to be on the Cougar Committee, but it's not my forte. But it usually works out to be a good process, and you can come to some kind of compromise as far as how to approach it. I know it's going to be as science-based as possible. So the recommendations for the permit numbers that you made this year are based on the past three-year average, though, correct?
They're based on the past three-year average, yes.
Okay. So in the Morgan Southridge, that is fairly limited access, is that?
Yes.
As far as you're
it's
concerned.
It's mostly so, private property.
Yeah, so it's going to be fairly hard to control permits there or cougar numbers.
What happened, so there is a little bit of that, but there are houndsmen that know those landowners and do have access to those areas. Kenny left, but yeah, there are people that can get into those areas if the permits are available. What happened this last year is that it closed down before it ever... we ever got the opportunity.
Because it was in the cache region.
Because it was in that whole cache region. Yeah. So there wasn't any real harvest there.
Okay. Thank you. Jim, you ready?
Yeah, I'm ready to make a motion.
Yeah, is there any additional discussion before Jim makes a motion? Seeing none, go ahead, Jim.
I move that we approve the recommendations presented by the division tonight.
Second.
We have a motion from Jim Gaskell and a second from Bryce Thurgood to recommend the Wildlife Board approve the Cougar Management Plan revisions in 2015 recommendations. Discussion on the motion? Seeing none, I'll call for a vote. All in favor, please raise your hand. Say aye.
Aye.
Aye. It's unanimous. Okay, Leslie. Number eight, Fur Bearer and Bobcat Harvest Recommendations.
So for bobcat and fur bear, we are currently under a bobcat plan that went into effect in 2007, and it will go through 2016. The plan uses four variables to adjust permit numbers and season dates. So the variables are percent young in the harvest, the percent adult survival, the percent females, and then the set days per bobcat. So for the past several years, two or more of the variables have been outside of the target areas, which caused us to be more conservative with the permits that we recommended with a cap. But this year, as we looked at the variables, they started to fall more in line. Three of the four were actually within target ranges. And the set day per bobcat actually continues to decrease, and so things are looking better. And so, based on the plan, if less than two of the performance targets are outside of the range, we can return to baseline. Baseline recommendation is to have six tags per individual with the season from the third Wednesday in November to the second Sunday in February, with no cap on the number of tags that are sold. So the division's recommendation this year is to allow six permits per individual. The season will go from November 19th until February 8th, and no cap on the number of permits that are sold. Other fur bearer seasons, we have no changes from previous years, so beaver and mink, badger, gray fox, kit fox, ringtail, spotted skunk, weasel, and marten will be the seasons you see there. And that's what I have for you.
Thank you. We have any questions from the public on this presentation? Seeing none, we'll go to the council. Questions from the council on the presentation? Okay, we'll go to comment cards from the public. Kent, if you could pronounce your name properly, I won't get it right.
Kent Fowden, Utah Trappers Association. We support the division's proposal as written. However, we would ask the RAC to vote in favor of a two-week extension on the bobcat season, on the end of the season. We feel that that would augment the juvenile harvest. The big toms become more active later in the season, and they're more accessible. Thank you.
Thank you. Justin Smith.
Justin Smith, Houndsman. I just want to say maybe I'm in favor of the tag increase. One, I see like a problem I have. A lot of friends I know buy as many tags as they can. People that don't hunt, do whatever. Everybody gets on there. If it's three tags, if it's six tags, when it's only the $5, they buy everything they can. With that tag increase, maybe it'll keep people buying just a few. On that same note, those tags are selling out in one day, right? Bobcat tags, they're pretty hard to get. If we are thinking increasing tags, I don't see that many bobcats out there, but if we are thinking increasing, I wouldn't say just throwing it out there to no quota. Let's just ease it up. Let's keep the tags down to three so that there are some tags available for some other people. If you throw it right to six, same problem going on is one person gets on, buys six, doesn't give everybody an opportunity to get it. That's all I see on it. You know, we would never double tags on any other species, I don't think, or just throw them out there. If we think they're meeting their objective, let's just ease it up and let's just keep those tags low so everybody has an opportunity.
Thank you.
Yep.
Can I? So we did have concerns over that. So we looked back over historical data, and the most tags that we ever sold were 11,000. Back when fur prices were really high, we did see an increase in the number of tags that were sold. But harvest never exceeded what we had seen in previous years, because honestly, I think it takes a specialized person to trap and kill bobcats. And so harvest never really exceeded it, even though the tags were available. I think the people that have the ability to do it can do it, and those that can't, can't.
Stan, you checked. You didn't want to comment. Stan Bassett? Okay.
My name's Stan Bassett. I'm with the Utah Trappers Association, and I'd like to support the recommendations that the Utah Trappers have, what Kent there mentioned just earlier, along with the rest.
Cody Bassett, you checked. You didn't want to comment also. Do you wish to comment?
My name's Cody Bassett. I'm also with the Utah Trappers, and I just support the following statement that was presented.
Thank you. That's all the blue cards I have for this agenda item. Is there anyone else who'd like to comment? Be sure to give me your blue card, yeah? Thank you very much.
Kenneth Duncan, Morgan, Utah. I'd just like to make a few comments on the bobcat. I've hunted bobcat since 1962, and back then, there was no coyotes, there was a ton of rabbits, and a ton of bobcats. I treat 21 bobcats in one winter with my hounds. Right now, this year, in the last few years, if I can treat 2 to 3 a year, that's good, because what few are there, there's been some of we've run and it was a female, so we didn't take her, and they're learning to run good from the hounds. And so I just like to make that comment. I am not in favor of raising the prices, and I'm not in favor of having over like 2 or 3 permits. I've always said that it's a trophy animal and that it ought to be to where everybody can hunt. And I know the last 2 years there was a lot of houndsmen that waited too long and did not get a tag. And so you got lost out not only on the fur bearer's license, but you lost out on selling tags too. So you lost a lot of revenue the last 2 years because you instead of cutting it down to two tags and letting everybody hunt, there was a lot of houndsmen that went without them.
Ken, if the... Okay. If I could ask you a question.
Sure.
If the number of permits were unlimited, I think that's what the recommendation was, then those houndsmen still could get tags.
Yeah, sure, they would be able to.
But
I just don't agree with the numbers.
You don't agree with the number of number six, but you do agree with the rest of it. Is that okay? Thank you. Is there anyone else from the public who'd like to comment on this agenda item? Seeing none, we'll go to the council. Comments? Jeffrey.
Once again, it's more of a question. The gentleman that asked about extending the season a couple weeks out to try to get it more adult, can you give you your ideas about that?
I actually looked at this just harvest-based by week. And so I put these slides in there so that you could see. Female harvest tends to stay pretty steady, and this is from 2007 to this last year. So by week, harvest stays pretty steady through week 13. The white line is actually the average of all of the years. And same with males. Male harvest is a little higher than female harvest over the whole season, but we didn't see a drastic increase in the number of males toward the end of the season in the harvest.
Has there been concern in the past about for quality towards the end of the season if you extended it?
The quality is better later in the season. And I believe that the quality of the hides are better later in the season.
Okay. Additional comments? Seeing none, the chair would entertain a motion.
I move that we approve the recommendations of the division regarding bobcat season, next bobcat season.
Is there a second?
Second.
We have a motion from Jim Gaskell and a second from John Leonard to recommend the Wildlife Board approve the fur bearer and bobcat harvest recommendations. Discussion on the motion? Paul?
I guess I find myself concerned as we go from, I think it's three right now, permits, up to six as expressed by some of the members of the public. That's a pretty big jump, especially when you're still looking at 333 trapping hours per one animal. So,
Wesley, you don't have any information on those, the effort. I know it went way up when we had a large influx of green hunters. Is that a green?
Yeah.
And then it's been steadily declining as they learn or they drop out.
Yeah, that's part of it. I mean, it's kind of like the free ptarmigan permit. A lot of people go get them, but then they don't know where to go or that type of thing, and so then they don't go back and get them. I thought I had the effort here. I don't have it on here.
Okay.
Sorry.
Paul?
Just a question, Leslie. How many people filled all three of their permits under the three? Do you have that information?
Of course, I'm going to have a hard time finding it.
Or if you can just recall on average, or...
I don't recall on average. I can get it off of my computer back there. I don't have it on this file. If you want me to, I can go grab that.
Well, I'm just thinking that would address that issue. Is
if you jump it up to six and you and most folks only get two of the three, then it really doesn't make any difference. If you've got a number of people getting all three, then jumping it to six.
Al, this might be it.
May play the end of that.
Sorry, it's taken forever.
Are you familiar in the past when the pelt prices were up, we did get a large influx of hunters?
So that's what we kind of looked at was, and this might have it on here actually. So this has pelt price with hunters afield. And then it also lists the restriction, and I don't know if you can see that with the lights. But if you look... So this last year, there were 4,800 permits that were issued, even though the cap was at 46, and a lot of that had to do with our, Kenny can tell me, the oversale and the problems that we had with the computer program. So there were 4,800 permits that were actually given out. There were 1,640 permit buyers. There were 1,091 hunters afield. And of those, 825 were successful, and the total harvest was 1,870. And so bobcat hunters afield, it averaged 1.7.
So the number that could have potentially tagged out or is very small. Based on
4,868
permits, and you had 1,600 individual hunters, is that?
Yeah, so it averaged 2.3 bobcats per hunter afield.
But the success was actually much less than that because you only harvested 825.
Yes. So the successful people averaged 2.3. Average 2.3.
Got it. I think we're good there. Additional discussion on the motion? Seeing none, I'll call for, and I'll, let me read it again. So the motion from Jim, seconded by John Leonard, was to recommend the Wildlife Board approve the fur bearer and bobcat harvest recommendations as presented. All in favor, please raise your hand and say aye.
Aye. Aye.
It's unanimous. Thank you very much, Leslie.
Thank you.
Have that band right up with you. Chair would entertain a motion to adjourn.
I'll make a motion to adjourn.
Both of us make a motion to adjourn.